Maria. Welcome to the show. Nice to meet you. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. I'm really looking forward to today's chat just because it is a timely one. Not always is it the case that the topic we're discussing is necessarily super relevant to something that's going on right now, but today's definitely is. And it'll span beyond that town hall stuff that we're going to talk about. But before we get into that, selfishly, I want to learn a bit more about you. I've been following you for a bit of time and you are an unbelievable follow. So if you're listening and you don't follow Andrea, please go do that. Oh, man, you are. But I'm going to go on a little rant. You are crazy active. Like, and I don't know if that's like, I don't know if you're putting a ton of time. What I mean is like, you're very thorough and it's, you're somebody who I would follow, not like you, I would actually go find your account to see what you've been posting lately. And there are very few accounts I feel that way about where I'm like, oh, if it comes across my feed, just kind of in a natural way, no problem. But you're somebody who I'm like, oh, I'll log on to Instagram. And I'm like, oh, let me see what you've been up to, because you've been up to something. That's for sure. So tell the listener a little bit about you and what you do, and you do it really well. So,
Well, thank you. I do a lot. I wear a lot of hats, and you know, it's always really funny to me because I think people who find me on social media, they don't actually realize that I have a full-time job. I work in life sciences, biotech. And I work for a company that we develop assays and tools to analyze cells and study how they behave and use those assays and equipment and data to either test the safety or off-target effects of actual therapeutics that are going to end up in patients or during the research and development pipeline. And I would say I work primarily in immunotherapy, so treatments that modulate the immune system. Primarily, that's going to be things like cancer treatments or autoimmune disorders or other inflammatory diseases. Infectious diseases, that's my background and training is infectious disease immunology. And then also cell and gene therapy. So a lot of these rare hereditary diseases, a lot of the same sort of tools, technologies, research, assays, they carry over. So that's my full-time job. And I am very busy there. I've been with the company I've been with in various forms for a decade. And I now manage a team as well. So it's a lot of responsibility, but it's been really great. And I started doing kind of SciComm just as like a way to vent about my general frustration of the challenges of low science literacy and lack of emphasis on education and critical thinking. Probably starting when I was in high school, I think I found like one of my very first Facebook posts when you needed a EDU email to join. And it was me going on a rant when I was an undergrad about getting your flu vaccine or something. So, you know, it's been a life's passion. And, you know, obviously I've gotten more active in it because, you know, you see the actual harm, the consequences of misinformation. It's not something that's benign, particularly in the health and science spaces. So I also am the executive director of the American Lyme Disease Foundation, which is a nonprofit that is combating misinformation in the Lyme space, which is very rampant, very much embedded in the wellness space, often crosses over into a lot of the other pseudoscience that you see. And then I started my own organization, Immunologic, to do a lot of that kind of, you know, in a broader umbrella.
Awesome. Amazing. Yeah. I was going to ask, maybe was there a moment that you can pick out in your memory that maybe triggered a, hey, I need to speak up more in this like public health space, something that maybe triggered a, you know what, I need to start, maybe this isn't what I do in my day job specifically. It's very connected to what you do, but was there a moment of like, yeah, I gotta talk, like a moment where you realized, oh, this miss or disinformation is doing harm and I gotta speak up about it?
Yeah, so I mean, I think I've always done a touch of that. You know, when I was in college, I was obviously very invested. I did undergraduate research, and so I've worked in various research labs in academia and industry and all sorts of things. And I was very focused on like just the general perception of what like genetic engineering and GMOs were, because those same tools that we use to make medications and therapies that save people's lives, the same exact approach that we take to make crops that can withstand drought, that can add, you know, nutrients to foods that can make their own insect repellent, so you don't need to add more pesticides. But because they've been plagued with this concerted misinformation for so many years, we're not actually able to implement these tools that can actually improve the quality and the stability and lower the cost of foods for people around the globe. And so, you know, I was like, listen, like, just because you don't understand this word, or just because, you know, it sounds a little scary, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's harmful. And then, you know, kind of doing that just, you know, in conversations in passing. And then, of course, when the COVID pandemic started and I saw pretty much, you know, news by clickbait, you know, people claiming that it's sexually transmitted because a study found viral fragments in semen samples of ICU patients, you know, that doesn't mean that it's sexually transmitted. I was like, man, like, it's just like a deluge of fear and lies. And because of it, it erodes and undermines actual experts who are doing really important work every single day in all of these different fields. And it makes people money who spread this misinformation. And as a result, people are making poor choices for their lives. And that's harming their individual health as well. And so, you know, that was kind of like, I spoke with my boss and I was like, listen, like, I'm going to do this. You know, there's no legal ramifications, right? And she was like, as long as it doesn't interfere with you, like the time you need to do your job, like, no, it's fine. So I was like, all right, I'm going to go for it.
One of the things I was thinking about is early on is I'm on your, I get your newsletter on Substack, Substack is a platform. Kind of where I'm going with this is if you're a listener, you're not familiar with Substack is as a platform. It's obviously a very heavily written word based, you know, and I just, it's almost a shame that we aren't like 15, 20 years ago when like blog and written word and like long form written word content was like all the rage, because you would have been, I mean, you do it wonderfully. And I don't think everybody has the appetite for it. The just like written word long form. I mean, we're sitting here recording a podcast almost in lieu of doing something like that. But yeah, I think you do a great job. And if you are someone who's like, oh, I like written word, I'd rather read an article. That's maybe how I learn better. I think you do a great job with that. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I have told people, I guess the Substack app will actually read the articles to you. So if you don't like
to super cool, I didn't know that.
Read, you can have it read it to you, which I recently discovered. Now it's like an animatronic. It's not a terrible voice, but it's a automated voice. But yeah, for me, like I am analytical. I like to write things down. I like to have it all out in front of me. I like to be able to link to sources and have kind of that, you know, data. And I actually don't like being on video, or, you know, like I'm very introverted and I'm good at faking it, but then I have to like decompress afterwards. Sure, sure. I was perfect as a scientist, not great as a public persona, but you know,
you're making
you kind of fall where you fall, right?
Totally. And these videos aren't up on YouTube, but anyway, you do just fine. Speaking of undermining experts doing really important work, let's talk about this roundtable thing. And one of the reasons I actually want to address it is just because it is getting talked about. And I feel like there's my dad is asking me about it. My dad's like, what's with this thing at Kellogg's I saw or something, you know? And so I feel like as much as I'd love to, I don't know if I actually would love to sweep it under the rug. I think addressing it is actually more helpful. But as much as I kind of, there's like some eye rolling, you know, kind of eyebrow squeezing, you know, kind of sigh, ugh, sort of mentality around this, I do think if the listener isn't necessarily up to speed with what happened, what it means, who was there, why, who was there means something. And I think we can dive into some of the claims by some of the people, but I'd like to take a little bit of a step back, broad stroke. What was this round table all about? Who organized it? Who was there? And then we'll go through some of the things that we thought were problematic with it.
Yeah, so Senator Ron Johnson, who is a member of the GOP kind of, you know, group within the U.S. Congress, if you have any international listeners, he essentially kind of unilaterally decided that he was going to host this panel, and he called it the Congressional Roundtable on Health and Nutrition, a second opinion or a second look or something like that. And ultimately, it was positioned as a cohort of experts on health and nutrition, and they were given a platform and a podium and a public viewing to essentially talk for 4.5 hours about all of these things that they claimed were harming our health and their purported solutions. And, you know, the TLDR is it was actually none of that. And the panelists were not qualified to speak on those topics, but many of them have decades-long history of doing this. And there's a lot of hypocrisy involved too, because they're, you know, saying that they want more oversight on certain food products, but many of them actually promote the deregulation of, say, regulation of supplements, which was taken away from the FDA, and Ron Johnson in particular actually wants less regulation. And so, you know, they kind of talk out of both sides of their mouth saying they want people to be healthier and safer, but all the things that actually are being done to keep us healthier and safer are, you know, we're going to take those away. And so, you know, that actually is kind of segued into this Make America Healthy Again, the MAHA movement, which is spearheaded by RFK Jr., who was on the panel. He's now, you know, he was running as a third party candidate. He dropped out and is now joined Trump's campaign. But really all it is his whole children's health defense shtick rebranded as this, well, we're, you know, the government is poisoning us and these are all of the solutions. And this is the same stuff that he's been saying for over 2 decades, and he's making millions of dollars off of it.
Can we talk about how he's making millions of dollars off it? Because I think that like there's like a people are assuming, oh, it's a different of opinion. This is an altruistic thing. There's research on both sides. Like nobody's the you know the irony of, you know, big pharma is profit driven. The big food profit driven is like positioning himself as altruistic in nature, doesn't benefit from this sort of rhetoric at all. And I think that that's just people aren't realizing that that's not the case.
Yeah. So I wrote a long newsletter about him specifically when he came up recently about his brain worm. And I talked about, you know, whether that was plausible, but I also was like, listen, like, that's fine. You can talk about him all you want. He had a cut off whale head in his car, was dripping juice on his daughter, whatever. But like, that's not the problem. The problem is that he's been doing this sort of anti-science activism for decades. And it actually started with his pseudo-environmentalism, right? So often I'll talk to people and they are like, well, he's an environmental lawyer. He's an advocate for the environment. But actually, you know, just because he's a lawyer that practiced environmental law doesn't mean that he was actually advocating for the environment. And so when he started this really back in the 80s, he was working with an organization called Riverkeeper. And Riverkeeper was an NGO that blocked the implementation and spread misinformation about modern energy. So green energy technologies like hydroelectric and nuclear power. And these are sustainable and environmentally friendly energy solutions over, you know, burning fossil fuels. And he was a lawyer for them. And so his job, his profession is making a convincing argument in a court of law. It doesn't mean having data to support your argument. It means making an emotional appeal that convinces people or convinces a judge. And I think there's this misconception that a lawsuit equates to scientific data, and that's not the case. And that's often what he uses as evidence that pesticides are killing people because someone won a lawsuit. And again, that's not the case. But basically, he was doing all this lobbying, doing all these lawsuits for Riverkeeper in the 80s. And this basically like allowed him to kind of position himself as this like champion of the environment. But it's not, because Riverkeeper was actually against all of these tools that actually help our environment or would help our environment if they were able to be implemented, if not for public outcry. And so then in 2000, he started his own law firm, and basically he's making a lot of money by filing frivolous lawsuits, suing companies under the guise of pollution. And that's really where this whole chemophobia, this anti-chemical rhetoric. So it was like, initially, okay, he maybe had a few lawsuits that were legitimately like there was a spill and there was remediation that was required. But that's an exception to this idea that every chemical in all doses and all exposures are harmful. And so, you know, he essentially leveraged this, made a lot of money with lawsuits, and kind of propagated this idea where, well, if you care about the environment, then you have to be against all chemicals. And we know that everything is chemicals, so that's completely absurd. That same year, so year 2000, 1998 was the year that Andrew Wakefield published his completely fabricated study on the MMR vaccine and its link to autism, but it wasn't retracted for another 12 years in 2010, even though within days of publication, experts, you know, all were like, this is flawed, these data aren't even real, et cetera, et cetera. So in 2000, RFK Jr. took up that mantle and he was like, chemicals cause autism. It's the vaccine chemicals. They're causing autism. So it wasn't just like this pollution. It wasn't just this environmentalism. It was, I'm going to basically take this chemicals are killing us and parlay this into all sorts of things that touch human health. Then he also got into the anti-agriculture, anti-GMO, which often coincides with the anti-chemical kind of beliefs. And this is something that crosses party lines, right? We see a lot of people who are like, oh, you know, synthetic chemicals, they're bad, but the natural chemicals are good. And then you have to remind people that, you know, botulinum toxin is a natural chemical and it's, you know, one of the most toxic substances that we've ever identified. And ricin is a natural chemical from a plant, and abrin is also a natural chemical from a plant. And these are incredibly toxic at very low doses. But so basically he started the anti-agriculture disinformation as well. And this, he actually was one of the first people to fabricate the link between glyphosate, which is one herbicide, and cancer. So he actually started these lawsuits that everybody uses as evidence that glyphosate causes cancer when he was working for a law firm called Morgan & Morgan. And this, of course, fed right into all of the other anti-chemical, anti-science, anti-modern technology beliefs. And because glyphosate in the context of agriculture is used specifically for certain genetically engineered crops that can tolerate it, so you can use it as an herbicide to kill weeds and you don't have to use multiple different herbicides, it also fed into the anti-GMO movement. And it's always ironic because there's a lot of other pesticides that are used in all types of farming, but glyphosate got singled out, and it's because of these lawsuits that he actually spearheaded. So he made a lot of money on these lawsuits, if it wasn't clear. Lawyers make a lot of money on lawsuits. And he basically, you know, move that into, well, GE technology, genetic engineering technology, is harmful. It's depleting nutrients from the soil. It's killing us. It's poisoning us. When in reality, GE crops actually allow us to use fewer pesticides. It's more sustainable. It reduces the environmental impact. It reduces the cost. And it actually can address many of the challenges we have in getting food to food deserts and other places in the world. But what he's doing is he's eroding trust in science and technologies that could be implemented to improve our lives and also the lives of the planet. And so, you know, with that, of course, they never mention that glyphosate is used like in residential areas. Like, people use it in their yards all the time, and they actually use it in higher quantities because they don't actually know how to measure it properly. Farmers use tiny amounts of it, but anyway, I'll digress. So the glyphosate obviously goes hand in hand with all conventional farming, because why not? So all pesticides, but only the ones used in conventional farming, are bad. And this is the same sort of tactic that Food Babe uses. Well, you've got to, you know, all the synthetic chemicals are terrible, and you know, we got to ban all these chemicals. And it's, and they don't think about, okay, well, what happens when you ban that? What are we going to use instead? And everyone's like, well, we just can't use, don't use pesticides. And it's like, they're used to prevent crops from being destroyed by pests, right? We're not just doing it for fun. They're not just spraying pesticides for fun, because that's more cost for the farmer and it's more work. They're doing it because weeds would strangle crops when they're young, and insects would eat the plants and the fruits and the vegetables, and fungal pathogens would infect them and destroy them, and viruses would do the same. So we need them to produce food for the 8.1 billion people on the planet. But the problem is that this message is very persuasive to affluent, predominantly white people who are like, well, yeah, I can go to my farmer's market and I can buy all this, you know, no pesticide only. And they don't think about all of the other people on the planet. RFK Jr. also like popularized the term factory farming and used it specifically in the context of conventional farming, when large scale organic farms use the exact same tactics to raise livestock and poultry. And then, so he's got all these things, right? He's got all these law firms. And then in 2016, he started this organization called Children's Health Defense. And again, the guise is, well, we're going to advocate for the health of children. And basically, it allowed him to put all of these things under one umbrella. And he sells ad space, and he does speaking engagements, and he writes books, and he gets a lot of money from donors like Organic Farms and the Non-GMO Project and the Environmental Working Group. And they give him tons of money to put out fear-mongering and clickbait about vaccines, about medications, about fluoride, about pesticides, about food products, about consumer products, about baby clothing, about your water. I mean, if you've heard any claims about toxins in anything, it started with Children's Health Defense and RFK Jr. And the people that kind of echo it now, is including all the people on that panel, it started with RFK Jr. That's where Vani Hari got it from, is from Children's Health Defense. And so he's made tons of money eroding health, undermining vaccines. He brought in, Children's Health Defense brought in $16 million in 1 year during the pandemic. And that is solely due to the fact that he is one of the top 12 people on the planet that spreads anti-vaccine disinformation. He's considered a pandemic profiteer by the Center for Countering Digital Hate because of how much money he makes from spreading lies. And I'm sure a lot of people know that he is single-handedly involved with the 2019 Samoa measles outbreak that led to countless babies dying, because he basically went to Samoa, hung out with a bunch of other anti-vaccine activists, wrote to the Samoan prime minister to try to convince him to stop vaccinating people once an outbreak was underway. And yeah, a lot of people died. 91.4% of the measles deaths in Samoa after that outbreak were in kids. So, you know, I don't know why people think that he cares about health, because all of his actions for since the 80s have actually been in direct opposition to improving health.
Wow. That was incredibly thorough. And it's been a long time since I didn't talk for that long. And so I appreciate that. Knowing that this is fucked right from the top, that the Senate, that between Ron Johnson and RFK, this thing was bound to be not good. I'm cracking up at thinking about the panelists, thinking about what kind of a person I'd want on that panelist, somebody with a nutrition background, a public health background. And I'm gonna read out some of like what the titles of these people were. And then we can talk about just some of the names, so because I think people are familiar with some of them for sure. I'm not going to say the name, but New York Times bestselling author, next person. Number one public enemy of big food, next person. Clinical psychologist, next person. Host of a podcast, next person. Psychiatrist, next person. New York Times bestselling author, next person. Host of a podcast, health and wellness girly, next person. Also, you know, the daughter of a psychiatrist. Next person, yeah. Real foodist on a mission to change the way America eats. You know, next person, the founder of Hugh Kitchen. You know, next person, New York Times bestselling author. Like, nowhere in here am I like convinced that this is a like who. And so knowing that this is kind of fucked right from the top, I'm not surprised that people like, you know, and I don't want to like, I don't want to do, there are probably things in here that are agreeable. But so when I pick on like somebody like Max Lugavere, who like, again, is maybe the best of the bunch, but still a net negative. And then we look at Food Babe, Jillian Michaels, Jordan Peterson, Michaela Peterson. How did Courtney Swan get on here? I have no freaking clue. Whose coattail was she riding? Like Callie Means, Casey Means, like this is a shit show. It's a shit show. Yeah. There's not a person in here who has a real deep understanding of nutrition and public health. And I think that that's, how's that not obvious?
I know. Yeah, no, it's really interesting because, you know, I had, you know, obviously I've tackled a lot of the things that they talked about during this in, you know, over the years, but, you know, when you actually look at like what their qualifications are, what their conflicts of interest are, you know, and then, you know, people kind of like cherry pick. They're like, well, Marty Makary has an MD.
Right.
Okay. Well, you know, he's a GI surgeon. So he's not doing primary care. He's not doing anything related with, you know, obesity, lipidology. He's not a dietitian. And also he fabricated the claim that hospital errors, medical errors was the third leading cause of death. And during that very panel, he lied about cancer rates because he's not a cancer researcher. And he said that pancreatic cancer rates have doubled in the last 20 years. And I went and I pulled the data from SEER. And if you look at the data in 1992, the rate of pancreatic cancer was 11.1 cases per 100,000 people. In 2021, 30 years later, so not even in 20 years, it's 13.2 cases per 100,000 people. So we've gone up by 2.1 cases per 100,000 people. And that doesn't even include the fact that we have better ways to diagnose pancreatic cancer now. And so cancer rates are also a function of better diagnostics. But they certainly have not remotely doubled. And he just like made this up. And nobody, you know,
no one's there to challenge
him. Takes
them
at their word.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, he has an MD, or, oh, well, you know, he's a truth teller, or Casey Means, she has an MD. Why, you know, she wrote this book about good energy. Well, you know what? She got an MD. So she finished med school. She dropped out of her fellowship in head and neck surgery, which has nothing to do with nutrition. So she didn't complete her fellowship or residency. She never got credentialed to practice medicine. She's also not a scientist, so she basically has an interrupted career. She has a degree, but that's it. And then after she left her head and neck surgery fellowship, she started a wellness company called Levels, and they sell continuous glucose monitors to non-diabetics and claims that she knows the secrets to hacking your metabolism when she has zero relevant training in that. To give people a sense of what you do in medical school is you take very broad classes in the major disciplines, and then you specialize in your subspecialty once you do your residency and fellowship. I taught clinical microbiology to second year medical students, and the amount of microbiology they're learning pales in comparison to someone who's a scientist in that field. And the same is true for all of these other fields. And that's why specialization before they're able to treat patients is incredibly important. So her understanding of metabolism and nutrition and health is bare bones compared to people that do this for a career. So saying that she has an MD automatically gives her credentials, well, that's the appeal to authority, and it's the appeal to false authority because she does not have relevant credentials.
I put myself through listening to the 4 hours of this thing, and occasionally on two times speed. It's brutal. And all I could think about was, so they would like read out somebody's name, and they would read out their credentials. And after every time somebody read out their credentials, like, is nobody like, wait, you're not actually educated in this? Like every time they read out somebody's credentials, I would have been like, wait, so why are you specifically here? What? And then people would start talking, and every time it was like personal anecdote, like right off the bat. It was like, when I was two, and then back when I was experiencing this, I'm like, you can't. Everybody is starting with the credentials that don't match up with what we're supposed to be talking about, and then they lead with personal anecdote, and I was just, it was super painful to put myself through. What I'd like to do is turn to a more positive, and then we'll come back. What I'd like to do is just talk about maybe who should have been there, and that doesn't need to be specific people, but what kind of a person should have been here, and more, maybe more importantly, what should have been discussed. I don't know how deeply or specifically you want to go into specific things from a public health perspective that we think would be more fruitful to put time, investment, energy, government funding into, but generally who should have been there, and generally, or if not specifically, things that should have been discussed that would have been more fruitful.
Yeah, so, you know, this panel was about, you know, the state of health and nutrition in the U.S., right? And what are things that we can do to improve it, right? So if you're talking about health, you're talking about nutrition, we need the players that are involved in that. So you need scientists that are producing food and food production people. So you need farm workers, you need agricultural scientists, you need environmental scientists, you need biomedical scientists, you need chemists and plant biologists and regulatory experts and food safety experts and food scientists and molecular biologists and toxicologists and cancer biologists, if we're talking about the rates of cancer, microbiologists, if we're talking about, you know, food microbiology and food safety. You also need nutrition scientists because they're doing studies on, you know, nutrition in the scope of research. And you also need your public health, you need your epidemiologists because they're looking at population level trends. You also probably also want your clinical providers that are relevant. So these are going to be practicing dietitians. So those who have credentialed expertise and the ability to treat patients. You want probably some healthcare providers that actually treat some of these chronic diseases that they're talking about, like obesity specialists or endocrinologists, or even just some internal medicine providers, you know, get some GPs on there, talk about the perception of health and nutrition with their patients. None of these people are treating patients that they had on there, except for a psychiatrist, which has nothing to do with physical health and nutrition. And then on top of that, you need other people, if we're talking about, like, you know, the packaging of food, and, you know, obviously they have to vilify a single company because that's Vani Hari's whole shtick. But maybe we want to talk to some health economists to talk about what's economically beneficial, what's in our best interest for the economy. Medical historians would be cool because you could talk about trends in health outcomes over time. You also need people to talk about the interaction between the environment and, you know, farming land and people. So maybe even some anthropologists could add some value. And if we're talking about getting food to people, you need things like supply chain experts and packaging experts and things like that. But yeah, no, we had zero relevant experts. It could have actually been a really fantastic panel if it wasn't just performative to pretend that, you know, the MAHA movement cares about health, because they don't.
Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, if they wanted to kind of talk about what could improve health outcomes, they could talk about the fact that the U.S. is the only developed nation that doesn't have national health care. And why are the reasons for that? Perhaps because Ron Johnson himself has opposed any of the implementation of these things that could improve access to affordable health care for people, including Medicaid for low income people, which is really kind of disappointing. They didn't talk about other social determinants of health. So housing instability, affordable housing, you know, childcare, parental leave, all of these things that determine how we can feed our families, how can we afford preventive care. There was no discussion on emphasizing preventive care. So all of these panelists actually are anti-vaccine and anti-preventive care, but they'll sell you all of their supplements that will boost your immune system. So that's cool. And all these people actually want to deregulate government oversight on food safety. So they don't want the FDA and the USDA and the EPA to actually improve food safety assessment because of Trump actually cutting the budget. We're now having more foodborne illness outbreaks like the Listeria cases we're hearing about because now there's fewer FDA food inspectors to go to these production facilities. And so they don't actually want the food to be safer. They want to create a figurehead and say, well, Big Kellogg's is the villain here when their behavior and the people that they align with actually are the people that are doing all the stuff that make things less safe.
Yeah, yeah. That permeated through the entire discussion for sure. We're going to talk a little bit about Food Babe in particular, and I was thinking just the last like 48 hours as to why that feels, she feels like the big take home talking points have come from her, and I was trying to think of why that is and why she's almost like, that's how people have come to me and like, oh, did you see this thing about Food Babe at this thing, and oh, Food Babe's still around, look at what she did. It's almost like that is reaching more people, almost like she's been a voice of the people, which is the ultimate irony, is a complete 180 of what the actual truth is. And so she's a problem, she's a big net negative, and we're going to, and I don't want to skirt that, but in the hopes of us having a positive conversation about being helpful, I think we do need to talk about what she's doing, what she does, her philosophy, just her just appeal to nature 24/7, chemophobia 24/7, ingredient centric view of public health, distraction from again more fruitful things people could be doing. So I do want to talk about that, so we can lead with a little bit about, and I don't want this to be just like, oh, let's shit on Food Babe, but like who is she, what's her background, what's her shtick generally, and why is that a problem?
Yeah, so she's a woman who has a bachelor's degree in computer science. She worked as a management consultant for some financial institutions for a few years after college, and then she started her Food Babe career with a blog that has now grown into this monolith that makes her millions of dollars every year. Her whole shtick or her whole claim is that she's advocating for healthy lives, healthier food, safer food, but she actually does the opposite, and she uses all these tactics that are very common in wellness pseudoscience, like exploiting the appeal to nature fallacy. So, you know, falsely claiming that natural substances are inherently superior or safer or better. There's no context about dosage or exposure, and anything, even water, can be toxic at a certain dosage. She often exploits chemophobia alongside of that. So the appeal to nature goes hand in hand with chemophobia, is that, well, you know, all these synthetic chemicals, they're really bad. And all these chemicals you can't pronounce, they're also really bad, even though we actually have common names for a lot of chemicals, including natural chemicals, because it makes it easier for the public. But those long names actually don't mean anything about the safety. It just tells us how the chemical's structured. And then she also does this to insinuate that, you know, the scientists, the healthcare providers, the experts, the objective experts in these topics don't care about you. They don't care about your health. And they're in bed with all of these villainous entities to poison you, so that then the medical institutions can make money off of treating you and keeping you sick. And so it really is this full circle of wellness pseudosciences. You've got to first kind of fuel the medical conspiracism that, you know, there's some evil plot behind, you know, all of these medical things, erode and exploit low science literacy on complex topics, craft these messages that instill fear and anxiety, because that causes people to stop critical thinking and they're not going to use logic when they're looking at these. And then essentially say, well, you have the solution. And so that's kind of the pathway to this.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, her argument would be that you said objective experts. Her position would probably be that that's an oxymoron, that those people are not objective. I can answer it, but I'd rather you answer it more eloquently, which is, why do we think the appeal to this anti-establishment, anti-science, appeal to nature fallacy, obsession with, you know, obsession / glorification of how things used to be, why is that so appealing to so many people in 2024?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few reasons. So the first is really this low science literacy. 28% of Americans are considered civically scientifically literate. And that's a pretty sad statistic. And what that means is that only 28% of Americans have the ability to actually take in scientific information, understand what it actually means, and use it to make an accurate decision or discussion on policy. But over 50% of people consider themselves to be interested in these topics. And so they're interested, but they're getting misinformation. And so if you get misinformation and you don't understand the scientific fundamentals behind it, it's that much easier to convince you of that misinformation and this kind of repetition bias, right? The more you encounter this verbiage, the more you're going to believe it. And it creates this echo chamber, which is really exacerbated in the social media ecosystem because these algorithms actually feed people content that's similar to the content they previously viewed. So if you click on one of her posts, even if it's simply out of curiosity, you're going to be fed more and more and more and more and more of this content. So you're going to be under the perception that this is the majority of the world that you're living in because you're in this echo chamber bubble. The appeal to nature fallacy isn't new, certainly, but it's become accelerated because of also survivorship bias, right? We are extremely fortunate to live in a society that we've almost all but eliminated acute causes of death, right? We don't die from simple infections or infectious diseases as much as we used to, or contaminated water, contaminated food, stepping on, you know, a piece of glass, like all of these things, even trauma, right? Car accidents, things like that. You know, we have medical interventions that have solved many of these problems, right? We have vaccines, we have antibiotics, we have disinfectants, we have antiseptics, we have water treatment, we have sewage, we have, you know, all of these things. We have blood transfusions, we have surgical tools. All of these things mean that people are not dying prematurely of these acute causes. So they're living to a point where they're developing chronic illnesses, like cancers. They're diseases of aging, neurodegenerative diseases, cardiovascular diseases, and things like that. And so because people don't remember a world in which children were dying left and right of these diseases that are now either eliminated from our country or severely suppressed or, you know, treatable, there's this kind of lack of concern of it. And that's why we're seeing all of these preventable illnesses, you know, resurge. And many people that kind of believe this appeal to nature fallacy, they're quite sheltered. They often think they're very worldly, but they haven't traveled internationally, especially to developing nations. And I don't mean like going to a resort in a developing nation. I mean, going into a developing nation. I was in Uganda last year and I went to a local hospital that's in the middle of the jungle. And, you know, it's essentially an outdoor building with like a tent. And they don't know any different, right? They're doing the best with what they can. And they had a huge malaria outbreak and they gave everybody mosquito nets because that's actually funded by the Ugandan government. It's very affordable. And they told everyone in the village, and these are all remote people, very low literacy. Most of them have no education, put them over their beds. And the malaria outbreak wasn't stopping. And so they, you know, they take these motorcycles because it's the only way you can get up into these mountainous villages. And they're like, well, you know, show me what you're doing. And when they're not putting them over their beds, they're like draping it like a blanket, right? Because the phrase putting over your beds wasn't understood by the same. So it was like demonstrating that, oh, when you have to actually enclose your bed so the mosquitoes don't get in. And then the malaria like plummeted. And, you know, this is all about like education and communication. And, you know, I mean, these people that spread these appeal to nature fallacies, like, I just imagine like what they would do if they lived in a place like that, right? Like this organization there, a nonprofit, they've been able to publicly crowdsource funding to create a water filtration system so that people have potable water in the village. And before that, you couldn't drink water. You know, I mean, it's privilege and it's this survivorship bias and it's a little bit of this like superiority as well that allow people to basically think that, you know, they know better because they have no idea of what goes on, you know, outside of this, you know, in these little villages, you know, they would kill to have sanitary surgical equipment. It's really heartbreaking.
I mean, laugh is a strong word in terms of making light of this discussion, but I just think of a person from 100 years ago looking at us now being like, man, I wish we were back in the good old days. Like, you guys are living to 65, 70, 75, 80. Like, you're not dead at 30 from like tuberculosis or something, you know? Like,
right.
So I find that to be, I don't know, I find it to be ignorant to not understand that we're living in potentially, you know, I'd say almost objectively the greatest time in human history from a health perspective. And that doesn't mean everything's perfect. We have different problems from just abundance, yes, and other problems as well, for sure. But I just chuckle at like our great 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 grandparents being like, you guys are bitching about what now? Like, you know?
I know.
And so that pains me a little bit. I want to make sure in the next 10 minutes we can talk about why this sort of misinformation, and maybe specifically using chemophobia and this appeal to nature fallacy around organic foods versus conventional. Let's use that kind of as a board to make this point of why this sort of misinformation is harmful to the public.
Yeah. So, you know, the organic versus conventional food thing has been going on for several decades. And so, you know, if you polled the public and you ask them, like, if you purchase organic, why do you purchase organic? They'll tell you because it doesn't use pesticides, or because it's healthier, or because it's chemical free, right? And all of those beliefs are because of the type of misinformation that Vani Hari and very clever marketing by organic companies have been so successful at. It's a moneymaker. And the reality is that in the US, and actually in many other countries, because I often get that question as well, organic in the context of farming is a marketing term. It's essentially a certification that the USDA has that basically says that this particular farm didn't use any prohibited substances for a period of 3 years on the soil. But that doesn't mean that they didn't use substances, right? And so there's this perception that organic is pesticide free, and that's not true. Organic farming uses a lot of pesticides, and the only difference between the pesticides that organic farming uses and conventional farming is that organic pesticides are what we call unadulterated chemicals, meaning they are chemicals that exist somewhere in nature. They've been identified or, you know, initially isolated from something in nature, but they're not being sourced from nature in the way that it's being used in farming. They're being made by the same exact chemical companies that are making the synthetic pesticides as well, which is always really, really ironic to me, because they're like, oh, well, Monsanto, which doesn't exist anymore, but, you know, all these chemical companies, they make all chemicals, right? They make organic pesticide chemicals, they make synthetic pesticide chemicals, they make chemicals that we use as solvents in the lab, they make all the chemicals, right? So organic pesticides, let's take a step back. Pesticides kill things. That suffix side means to kill. So these things are all substances that kill a specific type of organism. So pesticide is an umbrella term, but it includes herbicides, which kill plants, rodenticides, which kill rodents, insecticides, which kill insects, fungicides, which kill fungi, and so on. So I'm just going to call them all pesticides because they're all chemicals that kill things. So organic pesticides are just chemicals that kill things that are unadulterated. Synthetic pesticides are chemicals that kill things that can be chemically altered. And oftentimes it's chemically altered from a previous natural version to change the specificity. So maybe it doesn't kill things as non-specifically. It has a more narrow target. Maybe it doesn't deteriorate as quickly, so you don't need to reapply it as frequently, because if it deteriorates too quickly and it doesn't exert its effect to kill the things that are trying to eat the plant, then it's useless. And so there's no difference, right? When you look at a natural chemical versus a synthetic chemical, whether it's natural or synthetic has nothing to do with it. What matters is the chemical itself, its mechanism of action, and how much of it you're using. And so organic farming, because they're using these naturally derived chemicals that are manufactured synthetically, they're generally less effective at killing the target pests. So they have to be applied in higher quantities, which means that more of that is getting into the soil and the environment. And because these pesticides are also less effective, it means that the crop yields are also less because the pests take some of the crops. So if you look at comparative yield, organic farming uses 84% more land for the same yields. And if you looked at the same land by land comparison, the yields are 55% lower than conventional farming. And so when we're talking about a planet that's overpopulated and deforestation to clear cut for farmland, organic farming is actually contributing more to greenhouse gas emissions, both directly and indirectly. When you look at synthetic when you look at organic pesticides, several of them used for certain types of species are actually more toxic at lower doses than their synthetic alternatives. And there's lots of things in nature that are toxic at very low doses, right? I mentioned ricin and abrin and botulinum toxin, but a very common fungicide that's used in organic farming, and it always cracks me up because organic in science, or organic means carbon, hydrocarbon chains, carbon containing molecules. It's not what it means in organic farming, and it always cracks me up. But and I say that because copper sulfate is used as an organic pesticide, but it's actually an inorganic chemical compound. But anyway, but copper sulfate is at least 15 times more toxic than a synthetic fungicide that's used as an alternative. In addition, it has to be applied at much higher quantities to kill fungal pathogens that would take plants. And it persists in the groundwater because it's an inorganic chemical that's made of a mineral, and it is also toxic to fish, humans, other species, and it doesn't biodegrade quickly. So when we can tweak things chemically to make synthetic pesticides, we can actually change that so they would biodegrade quickly and they don't persist in the environment. So so copper sulfate is actually one of the most heavily used organic fungicides in vineyards. And if you look at kind of the use of pesticides country over country, a lot of these countries where people are like, well, Europe is so much better, they actually use more pesticides per hectare of land than the U.S. does writ large. And it's often because they also are very chemophobic and have a lot of organic farming, and they use these ineffective pesticides, so they have to use really large quantities of it. So, you know, the pesticide thing, it's false. And on top of that, organic food's not more nutritious. It has, you know, no difference in nutritional quantity. It's not safer. The pesticides that you're getting on a finished food product are not at levels that you need to be concerned about, because those are actually monitored and regulated. And, you know, all these residues that they always harp on, they're tiny. We're talking about parts per trillion, and a part per trillion is 1 second of time in 31,700 years. So it's like nothing. And the only reason we can detect it is because we have science that allowed us to develop these really, really sensitive chemistry equipment that we can now detect these minuscule levels of things. So many organic pesticides are worse for the environment. They can kill non-target species. Organic food is not healthier. It is usually at least twice as expensive, but it only costs about 5% more to produce it. So these organic farms and these organic large-scale industries, they're monoliths as well. They're big food, right? They're just big organic food. They make tons of money. The organic food industry has tripled in size in less than 15 years. So it really is a lot of clever marketing that exploits that.
Yeah, lots of good information and lots of good. I had Food Science Babe on just to talk about this exact topic. So it's good for the listener who was there for that episode to also hear that again. And that you're right, that the markup on the organic food is insane.
The biggest thing is, aside from the fact that we could be using that farmland to grow more sustainable yields that are going to be lower costs for the farmers and the consumer, is that, you know, all of this fear-based messaging, it scares people away from buying conventional produce when it's exactly the same nutrition and safety and half the price. And that disproportionately impacts lower income families. And these trace pesticides don't impact health, but what does impact health is not eating enough produce and not eating enough fiber. And so you're actually making health outcomes worse by telling people that, well, organic is the only thing you should eat. And people are like, well, if I can't afford it, what do? I'm just not going to do it. And that's exactly the opposite of what should be happening. I don't like to contribute to that marketing and the anti-science rhetoric of the organic farming industry. And so I buy conventional because it is just as healthy, just as safe, and actually better for the environment in many ways because they allow for the 14 genetically engineered crops that we have approved in the U.S.
Yeah, agreed. And even on that note, going a frozen from a frozen perspective, frozen conventional produce being also just as good, just as nutritious,
yes,
often more nutritious and more cost effective. And you know what you're mentioning here is a huge one that is exactly what happened with these people at this round table. This chemophobia, this appeal to nature fallacy, this you got to buy organic, it's got to be natural. There's the 1% who can afford that sort of approach, who are going to be like, they're not going to have their day-to-day life impacted too much by this decision, but there are actually people, a lot of people, who don't buy fruits and vegetables because they can't afford organic. They're afraid of the Dirty Dozen.
Yep.
They're afraid of certain chemicals, and they're thinking, okay, this is not worth it. I'm not going to go the conventional route. I've had clients many times in the past say, oh, I should be buying this organic, right? It's like, fuck no. Like, you should be buying what you can afford, eating more fruits,
yep,
and vegetables. Like, why was none of like, yeah, whatever. I mean, listen, how can we get people to eat more fruits and vegetables, whole, minimally processed foods? How can we make that more accessible financially, more accessible logistically? Was not necessarily the topic of discussion at this roundtable, which is,
yeah,
which pains
exactly.
Me. Yeah.
And you know, they wanna obviously, they're holding up the box of Fruit Loops and talking about the processed foods, but they're not talking about, well, let's get people who are buying Fruit Loops to be able to be assured of the safety and the nutrition of the produce item,
yes,
or the whole grain,
totally,
or whatever. It's, well, we need to swap this one coloring with this one coloring in the Australian version, and therefore we're going to solve health. And first of all, the one in the Australian version is not allowed in the US because,
yeah,
it's been banned here. But second of all, that's not, you're distracting, right? You, those people, the panelists, are saying that GMO crops are causing all these health issues, which they're not. There's been 30 plus years of studies. GMO crops are actually more regulated than any other type of crop. And many of the things they claim are GMO, there's no GMO option for, because public outcry has prevented the implementation of them. Like, golden rice in the Philippines is currently being blocked by a court because of anti-science misinformation. And golden rice contains vitamin A, and that prevents pediatric blindness, which plagues developing nations like the Philippines. And so this patent-free genetic technology is not available because of misinformation. And that's the harm, right? We should instead be saying, listen, certain foods actually store better if you freeze them. So go buy those frozen artichoke hearts because they're an eighth the price of a fresh artichoke, you know, and they're packed with fiber. They're packed with all these good things. But instead they're saying, oh, conventional foods, they're toxic. They're poisoning you. And not only is that false, but now you're essentially further expanding these health disparities between the affluent who have healthcare and money and all this, and the people that actually need the support structures the most, and who are often inundated with misinformation and don't have the time or the financial resources to know how to parse out fact from fiction.
Do we want to close with just a brief, you can monologue, which you've done wonderfully, on these, just again, we touched on it just now, these ingredient comparisons. We're holding up a board. It's got the UK version. It's got the US version. It's got, these ingredients highlighted. They're not in the UK one. You know,
right,
the fucking irony of Food Babe, who is now knocking on Kellogg's door. The battle you're fighting is to make Fruit Loops healthier, which, by the way, is potentially,
right,
not even what you're doing. But that's,
right,
the battle that you're fighting now is hysterical. So can we talk about, okay, so we have UK French fries, and there was this thing, Donald Trump was serving French fries yesterday, and Food Babe tweeted, like, at least make them, if you get elected, make them the French fries that they get in UK. And so there's this big battle being, war being, it's actually not, it's, it's being fabricated as if there's this big issue,
yes,
here, of there's ingredients that we get in the United States that they don't get in XYZ other country because we have lower thresholds for regulation on this, and we should be, you know, we should have tighter regulations, which is ironically not what these people generally are fighting for, politically speaking.
Right.
And so let's talk about that a little bit. And I want to phrase it this way. So we have, we'll take the Fruit Loops because that's kind of what's been pushed all the way to the door of Kellogg's here. And is it A, true that there are ingredients that are banned here, that are banned in, you know, Europe, that are legal here? And then, is this a battle that will yield a meaningful outcome? We'll go with those two.
Yeah. So, yeah, the way individual countries regulate food ingredients is completely independent, right? It's not like, European Union looks at us and they're like, well, we're going to do what they did. Each country or each, network of countries has different safety agencies to do these toxicological assessments and these cancer epidemiology assessments. And what they do is they put together reports. And ultimately, it's decided by the government what they're going to do with the laws. And so it's often influenced by personal opinion and public outcry and misinformation. And that's why we're seeing, California frivolously ban things under the claim that they're banned in Europe when they're not actually banned in Europe. There are things that are permitted in the US that are banned in other countries. And on the converse, there are things that are permitted in other countries that are banned in the US. And amongst the ones that are permitted, every single food additive is regulated here in the US. So that's a common misconception because they're always like, well, we need regulation. Well, they're already regulated. They all have acceptable daily intake values that are assigned to them. And that means that you can't exceed a certain threshold. And those acceptable daily intakes are orders of magnitude more conservative than what was ever found to ever pose a risk, which means you can eat that quantity every single day the rest of your life and never have, a health outcome. But aside from that, it basically is this performative, exploitation of the risk perception gap, right? They're fixating on the singular food ingredient or the singular chemical and saying, well, if we just remove that, that's going to improve health outcomes. And it makes people afraid of foods that contain it when there is no food that is singularly harmful. If your entire diet is Fruit Loops, probably not great, but it has nothing to do with the food dyes. It has to do with the fact that it's lacking important nutrients and fiber and protein, all that stuff. But no one ever says that. That's hyperbolic, but that's often what happens when you try to have a discussion about it. What we should be focusing on are the social determinants of health and how they impact health outcomes. But she's created this very lucrative career of publicly targeting prominent companies and saying, well, I'm fighting the war that is going to keep us healthy. And then because of public outcry and peer pressure, essentially, these companies kowtow and they remove it from their formulation. And that's exactly what happens in other countries. So you look at Australia and you look at UK and you're like, well, why doesn't their Fruit Loops have Red 40, even if it's permitted? Well, it's because their people also freaked out about it because of misinformation. And so they replaced it with carmine, which is also called cochineal, which is from a scale bug. And we don't use it here because it has high risk of allergies, particularly amongst people with shellfish allergies, because it's from a bug. And it requires a warning that it has an allergy risk. So we use a very tiny quantity of a different coloring that has no demonstrable effect in people. And so all of the claims about, health impacts of these things are using these mega doses in rats where they're feeding them thousands and thousands and thousands of times of what you would ever realistically be exposed to. And so, they create this, we're not focusing on the big picture things that impact our health, like addressing climate change and food stability and food security, because they're demonizing GMO crops and modern agriculture. We're going to just fixate on this ingredient swap, which is not going to do anything in the grand scheme of health, because that conversation needs to be talking about equitable food access that's affordable and not scaring people about healthy, nutritious foods and making sure that people can get preventative care, because that's what actually improves health outcomes.
So, and I want to be respectful of your time. Please just give me a cutoff if we're getting close to time here, which I'm sure we are. But I had a little thought experiment. I had somebody in my DMs be like, well, it's a start, right? I mean, it's getting rid of, let's say, isolating the context of getting rid of Red 40. It's a start, right? And I think then I thought to myself, well, if I could snap my fingers and get rid of all non-nutritive, non-preserving, non-food waste reducing, let's say, preservative or chemicals that provide no nutritional value or a benefit to the environment or a benefit to shelf stability and reducing food waste. Like, if I could get rid of all the things that are, let's say, food, Red 40 is literally just to make it look a certain way. If I could get rid of those and snap my fingers, would I? Yeah, I guess. But that is not what happens in a real living, free living scenario. It is not a snap your fingers. It's a big to-do about nothing, and it's not a start. It's not something. People, oh, well, it's something. It's a start. It's actually a slippery slope in the wrong direction. So it's not like the beginning of something big. Because if it is in fact the beginning of something big, it's the beginning of going down a path that is, again, avoiding real, more fruitful, bigger ROI things. So it's not a start. So even though if you were like, hey, could you snap my fingers, you get rid of all non-nutritive things that actually aren't beneficial to us directly or indirectly, or just there for aesthetics, let's say, would I do it? I might, but it isn't a snap your fingers, because there's an opportunity cost, and there's an optics, and there's a furthering of misinformation and distraction from this, and an anti-science rhetoric. And it is a, it's not a step in the right direction. It's a step in a very tangential, perpendicular, if not reverse direction that furthers chemophobia, ingredient phobia, distracts from again, bigger ROI things we could be doing. So when people are like, so you just said you'd want it gone. I'm like, well, I think that by trying to make it gone, in today's real world scenario, we take a large sidestep, if not a huge step backwards. Although if you could, in a parallel universe, it wasn't there, like, fine. Like, I guess that's fine. But like you said, even though I'm kind of leaning on the fence of like, fine, I'd rather it be gone, I'm not worried that in the amount we consume it, it actually makes a difference. And so in the real world scenario of the time, effort, funding, money, opportunity cost perspective of where we could be putting our time, this is a terrible, terrible use of all of those things. And that's really, you can't isolate a hypothetical world where there's not a lot of things that are connected, that one decision doesn't, you know, exclude you from making another, because that is in fact the world we live in. And so that's what gets to me the most when people are like, well, it's something, it's a start. I'm like, well, it's a start of a dark direction that we would go in that helps nobody, is how I feel.
Well, and actually I think it's a start in the negative direction. You know, I know you're trying to make it a little bit more neutral, but
no, I would agree. You know, it's negative, but
but even when we talk about like something that's not adding nutrition or preservation or whatever, like for many people, food colorings are actually critically important. People who have sensory issues, people don't realize that like the appearance of a food is really important to how you perceive the taste of it and your likelihood to consume it or ability to enjoy it or craft a memory. And that's particularly important for people with sensory neurodivergence and so on. And so, you know, it would need to be replaced with something either way, because also it's an indication of quality control. And that's part of regulatory with food production. But besides that, basically Food Babe and all these people are saying, well, they know better than all of these experts that are literally have devoted their careers to assessing the safety of these things at the doses that we would be exposed to. And they're pressuring politicians and they're taking the autonomy away of scientists and healthcare providers and saying, well, they don't know anything. I know better because I'm a mom and therefore you should believe me. And then politicians are lobbied by powerful entities with lots of money and they create these performative bans, or they legitimize and amplify and platform it. And you're not assessing, you're not addressing the actual problems, and you're making it worse because you're essentially legitimizing this unfounded fear and telling people, well, we're removing it. And you know, you can say, well, it's not because it's not safe, but people aren't going to believe that. Once it's removed, they're going to be like, well, see, I told you so. That's their big gotcha moment. And so, you know, we see this kind of snowball effect. So, you know, very quickly, because yeah. But this happened with paraben fear. So parabens in cosmetics and shampoos, people completely mischaracterized this really terrible study that actually showed nothing, but it caused all this fear about breast cancer and parabens. Parabens are one of the safest preservatives, broad spectrum, very inexpensive. And so consumer demand forced companies to remove it. They had to replace it with something. The companies that didn't replace it with a preservative, now they have contamination issues and people are getting dangerous infections. And the people that did replace it, they replaced it with a substance that has 10 times higher likelihood of skin allergies. And it's more expensive and it's only effective against bacteria. So you have to also include an antifungal preservative. And that didn't just impact cosmetics, it impacted medications as well. And so it isn't in isolation. If they create this perception that this singular chemical is bad, it's going to impact many different sectors because people don't realize how science actually happens.
Yeah, and you shared somebody who was like, Kellogg should just maybe it was you who shared it. Kellogg should just take it out and call it a PR win and appeal to, hey, we're making our product healthier, guys. We hear you. Like, we're a company of the people. Like, they should just do that because it makes no fucking difference to them. I mean, you know, of course they're using it for certain reason X, but yeah, so that was funny. They should just call it a PR win, be like, yeah, it's a health food now, you know? Cool. Amazing. Super respectful of your time. Let people know where they can find you. I'm going to attach all the links in the show notes and I'll let you get out of here because you've just been wonderful.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I mean, these topics you could talk about all day, but yeah, you can find me at dr.andrealove on Instagram and Threads. My newsletter is news.immunologic.org. And my website is immunologic.org.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.